So I'm speaking this morning of personal eschatology, or those ways in which eschatology in particular considers each person. And in particular, I'll be considering how the Christian view of the end, and particularly in the view of St. Thomas, how that end affects our life now in some way. Because after all, if the end is our goal, then in some way we ought to be oriented toward that goal and seeking that goal. Now, St. Thomas is known certainly for orienting his entire theological project in a certain way around the theme of beatitude, or at least the second part. That largest part of the Summa Theologiae begins with a reflection on beatitude, on happiness, on what is it that that makes us happy. And St. Thomas says that human beings and all rational creatures seek beatitude, happiness, as their final end. It may be that some people claim that they don't really want to be happy, or that they're happy being unhappy. Well, if they do, this is very hard to make sense out of. In some way, really, you can say that somebody who is happy being unhappy, well, they're getting a kind of happiness or a kind of satisfaction or pleasure out of some emotion of sadness or whatever it is. It's really, in a sense, a kind of unassailable fact that we all seek to be happy in one way or another. Now, we do recognize that we cannot find our ultimate beatitude in other creatures, even one another. We cannot find our ultimate beatitude even in higher creatures, as St. Thomas says, such as angels. And also, of course, though, St. Thomas holds that it is possible to reach a kind of imperfect beatitude in this life. That is, the happiness that we can obtain by our own powers, which is proportioned to our powers. So that would include the life of virtue that is contemplative and active virtue, that includes a life with friends, that includes health and bodily necessities. We recognize that without those things in this life will be fairly miserable. But with those things, we can say that we have a kind of happiness, but it's still imperfect. And even if we should make the claim that it is perfect, which Thomas wouldn't make, but if we should claim that even such a happiness would be perfect, it would not be a happiness that anyone would suggest could last forever. So we know this from experience, right? And we know the experience of reaching something that we have really, really wanted in this life, right? How perhaps the most important kind of goal in this life, to be able to find one's vocation in some way, the vocation of marriage, the person with whom one would like to spend one's life, being able to give birth and raise children, the deep joys that are involved with that. These things, these relationships, bring a kind of happiness in this life, but they're not enough for us. They are not enough to satisfy us. And in fact, when while there could be a honeymoon in such relationships, there's usually a moment at which one realizes this. Even this marriage is not going to be enough. Even the joy of children is not fully enough to bring us ultimate happiness in this life. We always recognize that there is something missing. Now, Thomas holds, of course, that there is such a thing as a supernatural beatitude, something that will, in fact, fulfill us, that will be what we desire, that goodness, that ultimate goodness, which is what we desire. And it is God himself, of course, who is that goodness. And he is the end, of course, of all creatures in one way or another, as we mentioned yesterday. Not only humans, but also angels, those creatures above us, and also the creatures below us, animals, plants, and minerals. But rational creatures, ourselves, and the intellectual creatures above us, the angels, can act consciously and freely for our end. So, we, as rational creatures, just limiting ourselves to humans for now, can know and love God, who is all wisdom and goodness. So, we seek truth wherever we can find it, and so shouldn't we seek the one who is all truth? We seek goodness wherever we can find it, therefore shouldn't we seek the one who is all goodness? And this is God in both cases. And so it is that Thomas reasons, I'm skipping several steps and not claiming that this is a kind of proof or something like that, but simply to mention what it is that he teaches. He says that we can reach a kind of union with God in what is called a vision of God's essence. So it is a beatific vision, the vision of God, who is our happiness, who gives us final happiness. Now, this vision is not reached through bodily eyes, even after our resurrection, but rather it's an operation of the intellect. And indeed, because we are finite creatures, cannot be fully engaged in even by us, we need help. We are not capable of even the operation itself, except by God's own help. And this is the way Thomas interprets the notion of the divine light that assists the soul in seeing God himself. It's a kind of inner assistance that God grants us to be able to be united to him. And this vision cannot be reached in this life, but can be reached only after this life. And once it's attained, it is definitive. So I'm just kind of laying out some basic things, and then we'll get to some certain perhaps problematic aspects. Now, one misunderstanding of the goal of Christian life may be the notion that something like a kind of obedience to God should be a kind of goal of human life. Now, certainly God's laws are good for us along the way in which we travel, but we're not called merely to a kind of stoic shunning of appetite or passion. This came up yesterday, too, in one of the questions. Now, certainly, we ought to recognize that any enjoyment of pleasure and even intellectual joy in this life can only be temporary, and so should be treated as such. But we are more fundamentally, positively oriented toward final happiness, a goal that we will reach only at the end. And so this, in a way, should relativize, without emptying of meaning, but relativize those highs and lows that we experience in this life. So now a kind of question that, and this comes more from certain theologians over the last few decades who have wondered whether this picture of the beatitude of the soul involves necessarily a kind of denigration of the body. That is, so if the soul can reach its final happiness without the body, in fact, if it can reach not only its final goal without the body, but in a sense, has to be without the body in order to reach that ultimate happiness, then doesn't this, in a sense, denigrate the body? Doesn't this say, in some sense, the body is keeping the soul from happiness? It seems to say something like that. And, in a way, Thomas's conception of the beatific vision and the end in general was critiqued in this manner. First of all, I'd say the following in response, or at least the following ought to be taken into consideration in addressing that kind of question. And I should say there are certain types of, there are certain strains of spirituality that at times do seem to denigrate the body. And if you look at St. Paul, for example, at times he speaks of the spirit and the flesh warring with one another. And so it is that at times, of course, one would have to then nuance what he means by the flesh there. I think I would say he means the flesh as a kind of idol or as a kind of end in itself. But in any case, the question remains, and certain spiritualities do seem to simply want to, in a sense, set the flesh aside in favor of the spirit. But in any case, the following considerations should be taken into account. First of all, in Thomas's account of the afterlife, the saints' souls are separated from the world, the material world, but only temporarily. It's a kind of temporary condition of the world, one that will be finally overcome when the Lord Jesus returns, quote, with all his holy ones, 1 Thessalonians 3:13. So, yes, it's true, it seems, in the current epoch, way things currently are, we can only be united to God with the separation from our bodies, or at least our souls that can be united to God only after the separation from the world. But that's one thing to keep in mind. This is only a temporary condition of the world. As we mentioned yesterday, of course, the world is to be renewed, and at that point, the souls of the saints will take on flesh and be reunited with the body, and there will then be the saints once again will be with God, body and soul. So that's one thing. This is a temporary situation. Second, it is being with God, not separation from the body per se, that makes the saints blessed. So when I mentioned that it seems that separation from the body is what allows for union with God, well, that does seem to be true in the current state of affairs, but that's merely a kind of, given the current state of affairs, a necessary condition, not a sufficient condition. One must also be found among the just. And this is where a very common doctrine theologically comes in, a common but not orthodox doctrine comes in, and that's the doctrine of universal salvation. There has come to be, in theology, a kind of, in the last few decades, we could say even the last century, a kind of tacit belief that, well, even if salvation isn't universal, it's virtually universal. In other words, unless you're the worst kind of murderer or war criminal or something like that, we'll all be taken care of. After all, God wants all to be saved. And so this kind of has become a kind of background belief. And so if you have that kind of background belief, then the notion that once death comes, this means a separation of the body, and if for all practical purposes, virtually everybody is going to be among the just, then of course what it looks like is, what it takes in order to have union with God is basically to be separated from your body. So this is not the way St. Thomas says things are to be. Of course, he holds that, that there is to be a judgment, and it is the just who are to be admitted to the beatific vision, not simply everyone or virtually everyone. So that's to be taken into account, that second matter. And finally, of course, in a related way, the condemned do not share in the consolation of the union with God. For them, separation from the body is the beginning of eternal punishment. For them, departing from the world, or for their souls, if we want to be more precise, as we should be, departing from the world and from the body, it's not the beginning of liberation, but the closing off of the last chance at liberation. So there's no more hope in the souls who are condemned, and no more hope for hope. So it is that, in St. Thomas's view, our existence in the corporeal world is a good thing. It is in accord with our nature, and so good. But it's also a kind of mixed blessing, as it were, because in our present state, the world is, yes, fundamentally good, but also flawed. It's only at the end that the admixture of evil is removed from what God has created to be good from the beginning. And yet, of course, there's a sense in which Thomas will speak of the intermixture in this world of the good and the wicked as having a kind of mutually beneficial effect. The good can be tried in their patience and virtue by the wicked. The wicked can be helped to be converted by the presence of the good in the world. And so this is why there's this kind of mixed state of affairs currently. So that's one problem that can be sort of one question that can be raised against the Thomas's view of beatitude, that is, whether this sort of denigrates the body. But then the question might be, well, then what good is the body? What can the body add to beatitude? And let's make this a little bit sharper, because St. Thomas will say, not only is the soul, the separated soul in beatitude, souls of the just, not only are they in beatitude upon death, but they're even in perfect beatitude. And when Thomas was teaching this, this wasn't yet officially taught. We have to wait for Benedict XII and Benedictus Deus before that becomes solemnly defined. Some point to Benedictus Deus as perhaps one of the few exercises of sort of ex cathedra magisterium in history. Benedictus Deus in 1336, I think, in which after his predecessor, John the 22nd, I think it was, sort of floated informally the idea of the notion that it would be only at the resurrection that there would be beatitude. There had been rather a tradition, a teaching that the souls of the just are in the hand of God, and that they are with God. And really, from St. Paul's statements, such as I would prefer to be away from the body and with the Lord, but for your sakes, I am with you for the present, and a couple of similar texts. The tradition had it that the saints are the souls of the saints are with God, and of course the tradition of the intercession of the saints would argue for such an interpretation as well. So in any case, it was somewhat controversial, but still rather the common opinion when Thomas was teaching that the souls would be reach beatitude. And not only beatitude, but even perfect beatitude. And this is what ends up being taught by Benedictus Deus, by Benedict XII. Indeed, so a couple of generations basically after Thomas's death. And but then this question is, what can the body add to beatitude? And in fact, of Thomas's own opinion on this matter seems to have undergone a certain development over time. In his earlier writings, he held that the beatitude of the body would, in fact, the beatitude of the soul itself would increase in intensity due to the addition of the body at the resurrection. Because somehow the soul is, of course, the form of the body, that there would be somehow a kind of way in which the soul itself would be in greater beatitude due to the addition of the body. His later solution denies that. He says rather that there is no intensive increase in the soul's beatitude. There's only an extensive increase in beatitude. That is because due to the addition of the body. So whereas earlier he had said there'd be an intensive and an extensive increase in beatitude, he later says there's to be only an extensive increase. So that is, in a sense, if you want, speaking sort of loosely, there's more of you to be in beatitude after the resurrection, not just your soul, but the unity, you in your person, the soul, body, unity in your complete nature are to be in beatitude at the resurrection. In a sense, this involves a kind of overflow from the soul to the body. The glory of the soul, in a sense, flowing over in a analogically speaking, to the body, so that the body and the entire person then participates in body in the beatitude after the resurrection. We can say that the beatitude of the soul is perfect after death, the soul of the just, but this is not yet the beatitude of the whole human person. So there is to be this kind of extensive addition. There is also, Thomas would say, a kind of addition of joy, not to the essence of beatitude, but to its bene esse, or well-being of beatitude, by the addition of those others who are to be saved with them. As the company of the elect increases, so there's a kind of shared joy that increases as well. So this is how this kind of difficult question is dealt with, the difficult question of what the body can add. And we can go into some reflections on what the risen life will be like. It's hard for us to imagine. What would we do? What would we want to do? Given that the souls of the saints see God, there shouldn't be anything else that one should want, for all perfections are in God already. Yet, it is a good that a nature be fulfilled. The soul, in some sense, is, without informing the body, is incomplete. It has a kind of incomplete kind of existence. And this is pretty clear in Thomas's teaching. And it comes out in his doctrine on what he believes about the bodily remains. Now, this is going into Thomas's anthropology a little bit, but Thomas has a strong view of the unity of the human person, that there's only one substantial form for each person, and the soul is that form. So therefore, at death, what is left behind at death is, in a sense, not even body. You have to speak of what's left as the remains of the body. The material component is left behind. Because in a sense, the formality is all on the side of the soul. Even bodily-ness is on the side of the soul, and what's left behind is the matter. But Thomas will say that there still remains a kind of relation to the body, or bodily remains, actually, because it's not the body yet, or anymore, but is bodily remains. And he holds that at the resurrection, these remains should be somehow reunited with the soul. Now, he also goes through problematic cases. What if you have a case where you had a tribe of people who are entirely cannibalistic, and the only thing they eat are other people, and this goes on for generations? So basically you have individual after individual after individual who share the matter that's been used by someone before. So which remains are going to be reunited to which soul? Well, Thomas will say that, well, yes, of course, such problems are true, and he understands that that the body is, as we might say, is something like a kind of river, right? This kind of matter kind of flows through it. There's addition and subtraction as we go through life, with the soul kind of being the central principle of identity, with the matter of the body being kind of changed out, as it were. Well, how does he solve the problem? He says that there must be at least some small part of the matter left behind at death that will be raised for, that is most associated with each soul. And he suggests it could be, it's just a suggestion, a speculative suggestion. He says it could, perhaps the seed, you know, from one's conception, but you know, that matter that allowed one to be produced. But he just says that as a suggestion. So he says then of course God can make up the rest. Now, why not just say, well, it doesn't matter where the matter comes from. You know, all the matter could come from something else. And Thomas would say that would be theoretically possible, because in terms of logical consistency, because the identity of the person is entirely on the side of the soul. The matter left behind doesn't have any signate quality whatsoever. He understands, you know, it can be, you know, eaten by worms, and the worms can be eaten by birds, and be scattered. But he says, what we believe in, this is what's revealed, what we believe in is resurrection, not replacement, but resurrection. So that means there should be some part of matter that had been left behind at death that is raised. And I think it has an important theological import, because if you don't say that this resurrection is needed, what you end up saying is that what happens is a kind of replacement of the body. And redemption isn't about replacing us or the world, but about making us holy again, in a sense, returning us to God from whom we have come. And so it really is a kind of a doctrine that underlines the goodness of creation, the goodness of the material world. And in some way, this is part of Thomas's whole way of proceeding in his theology, and also shows, I think, that his philosophy doesn't end up sort of controlling the theology, right? He deals with the reality, the revealed datum of resurrection, that we are promised resurrection and not a replacement body, which his philosophy of the unicity of the soul, that oneness of the human soul, it would allow for a bodily replacement as a logical possibility. But that's not what's promised through Revelation. What's promised is resurrection, a rising again of the body. So with Thomas's view, then, there is this kind of link that remains between the separated souls and the bodies. There is a kind of desire for the body, if you will, in addition to a desire that all those to be saved come to beatitude, and a kind of desire also to see the world transformed. But speaking of a desire on the part of those in perfect beatitude, even if separated souls, is a little bit problematic because desire is normally associated with an absence. It's when you desire is left in someone something you don't have and that you want. And so you can only speak of desire, and Thomas will he addresses this head on and just will say it's not the kind of desire that would bring any disquietude to the soul, because the soul has rest in God. And certainly, in the vision of God, one would not need a kind of faith or hope because for this, it's a sort of fait accompli. You know, one would know that all of this is going to happen, and so there would not be a kind of disquietude there. One might speculate about what that experience is like, if there's this kind of experience on the part of the souls. Thomas doesn't really do that. His perspective tends to be more ontological than, or objective rather than subjective. Although and there are people, philosophers and theologians who can, in a sense, kind of extrapolate, not just extrapolate, but also tease out places where Thomas speaks of things like we would speak of as subjective experience. The first point of reference is a more kind of objective reference. So we can speak of the souls of the just being in the hands of God, and we can speak of them as being in perfect beatitude. But perhaps it keeps our perspective in check to recognize that. In fact, they are not yet perfected in their full human nature. That there's a way in which they're not yet perfected. I think of, and I wrote something on this with respect to funerals and a Christian approach to death. I remember a funeral for a particular religious sister who I found to be very inspirational, and so did everybody at the funeral. She's from my hometown in Spokane. So this was the kind of person about which, well, yes, we were there when you're at a funeral, you're there to pray for the dead, and we're there to pray for her, but there wasn't a lot of serious doubt about this particular person being with the just, or if she's in trouble, we figured, well, basically we're all damned if she's in trouble. So but even in a case like that, there's a loss, and not just a loss for us. So there's a loss for us, because she's taken from us. But even for herself, because she's not a full human person until the resurrection. We can say, you know, her soul is at rest with God, but she is incomplete, and the world is incomplete, and the number of the elect is incomplete as well. Not all those who are to join in beatitude are complete yet, and so there is a kind of sadness, just as there's sadness in the 3 days of Christ in the tomb. Even if you had perfect faith in the resurrection of Christ, you'd still have sadness at the loss to come. I would suggest that perspective ought to be part of our approach to the eschaton, because it's only when Christ comes again that death finally will be swallowed up in victory, and every tear will be wiped away, and God will be all in all.
You commented that Thomas acknowledges that you, as a matter of course in our lives, our bodies lose in gay matter. Does he think the glorified body will do the same?
No, because of the gift of impassibility and incorruptibility. Yeah. So both those, in a sense, so that's part of the way that one of the necessary attributes of the risen. That they'd be not capable of suffering and not capable of corruption either.
Well, so, I mean, what is corruption? For example, with a piece of hair falling off in the shower, that has corruption.
Well, that's a pretty low grade corruption, but
it is.
But yes. Okay. Yeah. So for example, when Thomas says, if you're interested, look in the supplement, for example, the Summa, you will see these various objections. So there's an objection to the weeping and gnashing of teeth. Well, and this is for the damned, by the way, because they're going to live forever too, in an everlasting way. Well, if they weep, that means a shedding of tears, and that would mean a loss of matter, and that can't go on forever. So that's an objection against the weeping. And so Thomas would say, well, yeah, but they'll weep, but without some kind of loss of matter. So, a few details get left unexplored.
Since we really don't know what's a normal or perfect in a physiological or biological sense, in the sense that, like, when children are born with Down syndrome, we label them, and our society now is, trying to terminate those pregnancies in which we know for all definitive purposes that child will be born with Down syndrome. But, we can't necessarily state that particular pathologies or disease states are abnormal. So how do we reconcile that with the resurrection of the body? This is my first question. Then my second question.
Let's hold on to that, because I think that's important. Is it directly related or is it a different question?
No, the other question is just as far as age goes.
Okay, so let's stick with the first one because you bring up an important point. Where to start? I think on this we have to bite the bullet and say, there is such a thing as better bodies and worse bodies. That there can be a way of discerning what a body ought to naturally have and what it ought not to have. The consequences of denying that are pretty grave. Let me take myself as an example, so that makes it easy. I have a muscle disease, okay? So that's not in itself a good thing. I'm happy to exist, despite the disease, but the disease is not a good thing. And if we were to find a cure for it, derived in some moral way, I'd be happy to take advantage of that, So, taking that kind of view to an extreme, that we're not sure what is good. I mean, we know that people without sight, for example, born without sight, they can have a because of their heightened attention to their hearing, for example, and their other senses, they can do things, they can notice things with their hearing that people without sight cannot. So that can be a kind of gift to the world, even. But for all that, I think it stands to reason that we can see that naturally humans see, and that this is a kind of exception and a thing that is to be avoided. And so, Jesus healed the blind, for example. Maybe theologically, that's a good starting point. You know, he made the deaf to hear, and those with sight just to see. Certain ideologies around disability want even not to speak about disability, but being differently enabled. You know, so for example, I would be differently enabled, and because of my lack of strength, or this provides a kind of in the panoply of variety. Gives us a kind of different way of seeing things, and that's true. That it does do that, but it does it precisely by the fact that I have something less than, even less than I should have. So, I think that would be going too far. On the other hand, though, existence is the ultimate good for a given person. So to eliminate somebody's chance at life by killing them in the womb because of their disability, something like Down syndrome, is the gravest injustice to them. Bearing in mind that it can be difficult to have someone who's handicapped in one's life. It's not necessarily a walk in the park. So that's what I would say to that. And so then the question about age.
Yeah, my question about age is just that, basically, at what age do we come back if there's no such thing as, aging?
Well, some of you probably know Thomas's answer to this. He holds that the perfect age is basically the age of adulthood, full adulthood, probably around 33. This is why he argues it's fitting that Jesus died at 33, at the age of the perfect development, in a sense. There's a kind of increase and then a kind of decrease in capability, even though one can keep learning, but in terms of sort of raw abilities, there's a reason sports figures start retiring. Physically, at least, we see that's you're not going to get a lot better that way. So that's what he holds. And it's a very realistic sense of what's possible. A more recent writer, Hans Urs von Balthasar, he speculates that perhaps the one risen will be all ages. Well, that's a kind of an interesting kind of thought experiment, but for Thomas, we just say, well, you can't be all ages at once. I mean, that doesn't really help us picture anything. It makes it kind of harder to figure out what are you talking about. I mean, an old person is different from a baby, So, Thomas, speaking of biting the bullet, I mean, he does so when it comes to. Truths about the things like resurrection. You try to stick to nature as much as possible to try to figure out what's going on there.
Thank
so,
you.
Sure.
So I'm trying to figure out. I've been thinking about this for a while about why he thinks the matter having the same matter is so important.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, right. It's not strictly necessary, but there's some kind of fittingness argument there about it. But I don't think this is going to cohere with his metaphysics, right? Because the substantial form of the body, right, is what it doesn't. It's not just what unites with the matter to form a hylomorphic composite. It gives identity to the matter. So there's right. I mean, the identity of the matter itself is something which is posterior to form. And so there just is no question of the same matter unless it's the same form, right? So for Thomas, right, for matter to be...
I don't think that's true, but...
Well, in
it, if you have a given thing and it's in one form and it goes into, let's say, by some kind of substantial change into form B and C. So this is form A and this is form B and this is form C. So the matter that was here is now informed by form B and C. It's the same matter. It's the same. It's not.
Yeah,
I don't think
some,
that's controversial.
In some sense, it's the same matter, and it's really hard to say how though, because prime matter there's not a criterion of identity for prime matter. If there was, it would have form of some kind, and it wouldn't be prime matter. Let's leave that aside. Let's say you could have a criterion of identity for prime matter, even if you could, right? For my soul to be in union with some kind of matter is just what it is for that matter to be my matter, right? So, in other words, right, like if you, I get the fittingness argument, especially if you're talking about like, you know, this person's corpse is still in the grave and you unite their soul to some other matter, that's weird. They're like, this person's walking around, their corpse is still in the grave. But, I mean, strictly speaking, on his metaphysics, given his philosophy of nature and his metaphysics, what it is for a certain body to be my body is just for it to be united to my soul. And so any matter that my soul happens to get united to is the right matter. That's because that's all it is to be the right matter.
Well, I mean, that's all it is in this life. I mean, but once you die, whatever... the matter was that granted you have no way of there's no formal content that identifies it as the same matter, but that doesn't make it not the same matter. It is the same matter. I'm not sure how else to say that.
I just don't think he has the tools in his metaphysics to say that. I mean,
but he does say that.
I know. I'm just saying, but I mean,
I'm not sure.
I know.
I'm not,
he undoubtedly
no,
says that.
But I mean, the question is, what is metaphysics? I don't think his metaphysics demands that he say the matter set aside. That's where I think I would agree, which I tried to express basically. But it does allow for it.
Just a quick thought on the point about prime matter. Well, it's not as though matter is reduced all the way down to prime matter, but it still remains, you know, of course, in his cosmology, and at least at the level of the four elements, but you're not going lower than that in terms of the just prime matter. Does that make sense? So, like, the body, yeah, it gets eaten by worms, but it's never going to be reduced completely to prime matter before
the
resurrection.
Well, it depends on what you mean by reduced. Of course, yeah, you never get to a point where you just have prime matter sitting around on its own.
Right.
But every substantial change presupposes a kind of reduction to prime matter, right? A sense in which every formality is removed and replaced with that of a new substantial form. And of course, this creates puzzles of its own of how, you know, for example, some of the accidental qualities of a body seem to survive substantial change. And I think that the answer to that lies in some kind of story about virtual presence. But but I mean, yeah, I think his story of substantial change does require us to say, yeah, when there's substantial change, there is a kind of reduction all the way down to prime matter, because prime matter is all that survives the change.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say the same part. Also, that's not prime matter. I mean, in mixed bodies. Right. I mean, the forms of the lower elements remain virtually,
right?
You know, so they're not completely eliminated, and they reemerge, you know, once the superior form departs. So I don't see why that wouldn't give it a certain identity over time. And, you know, you said the corpse is still in the tomb, for example. I mean, we have that with relics, right? So what do we do when we venerate relics? Why would you venerate relics and not any other piece of prime matter or something like that? So there's still identity that lasts, you know, even on that level, and that has a reference to the saint.
Sure. I mean, this is basically what's happening. You have this kind of prime matter, the soul informing it. I mean, we know. I mean, I'm going to just say, for the sake of argument, calling it prime matter. In a sense, you have a bunch of these sort of whatever forms you want to call them, bones and meat and whatever in the remains at death, and the soul, and the human soul. I mean, that's the picture. And of course, yeah, so, you know, a bird comes along and eats this, and the tree is there in the neighborhood, and it takes nutrients from this, and, you know, the matter goes, it starts going all kinds of different places. It's not as if we say that some kind of new matter is coming in, because we know that, in not according to these words, but Thomas has a kind of, and the ancients have a kind of sense of conservation of matter. I mean, it doesn't sort of disappear. That's why he has to go through all kinds of gyrations to figure out what happens when you eat the Eucharist, right? Because it's sort of the quantity itself is the kind of unity for the appearances. That's maybe a place to look in terms of. How he deals with matter when he comes to a situation when he has to, but I think it is an argument from fittingness and from revelation. You know why that should be the case, that at least some piece of the matter left behind should be raised. Yes.
So is it like somehow better to keep the one's virtually present forms that are then there but don't have the soul intact in a way that more closely resembles?
Yeah, so that
so don't do cremation, is that
the implication? I'm just curious.
No, so it becomes a really interesting question. If the matter left behind, it doesn't destroy the person to cremate them. There's no question about that. It doesn't even, I mean, what are you destroying? You're destroying the remains. On the other hand, it's, you know, this is the person has been baptized, and this is the last thing left behind. It seems more fitting to do something less destructive. That's all I would say, really, out of respect for what's left behind, because burning the body just seems to be. More destructive than simply putting it in the ground, and it's the church allows for cremation. I always liked these kind of situations where you have these tombs and then the little hole. So you put the body, you put the remains in the tomb, you seal it off, and after 100 years, basically you have these just bare skeleton. I mean, unless it's a kind of incorrupt saint or something like that, and you just sweep the remains and it goes down into a hole, and then you put the next one in for 100 years, and you can, I mean, there's plenty of room on earth for that for till the end of time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is not, one wouldn't prove philosophically to the secular world this must be the case. This is what we try to make sense of based on revelation.
Yes.
So, but that brings the whole picture of revelation into place. And for that, I think we also want to consider we wouldn't be able to receive sacraments if we didn't have a body. All the graces that we receive through the sacraments go through our bodies, and the bodies are sanctified in that way too. They're the conduit. So, I mean, there's one more reason to honor them. You know?
That's a good point. And Thomas is interesting on this. You know, just to compare him with Bonaventure on the sacraments, for example. So, at Bonaventure, the primary reason why we have sacraments of, and Peter Lombard too. So, basically, in Lombard. writing in the later 12th century becomes a kind of standard text, right? The basic reason for sacraments is, in a sense, to humiliate us, to make us go to God through through lesser things, in a sense. And for Thomas, he takes a more an approach. So that's a theological opinion. Thomas will repeat it because it's something that the doctors say. But when he answers the question, why do we need to come to Christ through sacraments? It's, well, humans come to knowledge through the body, through the senses. All knowledge comes through the senses. This is the kind of being that we are. And so God, by his dispensation, makes himself known to us through bodily means. So it's a more positive take on the body, rather than seeing the body as primarily, and bodiliness as primarily a locus of sin. Yes, it can be sin there, but it's something, it's natural. This is the way we're made.
Good. So in terms of comparative religious phenomenology, so to speak, there are other religions that do cremation as a matter of principle. There tend to be those that don't believe in an individual survival or in certain forms of reincarnation. So the soul continues, but the body is irrelevant. But that also means the principle of individuation is irrelevant. So I think to talk about the resurrection of the body and how we treat the body has to do with the uniqueness of that one existence that we have. There is not a reincarnation, there are no cycles or any of that sort. And it is interesting that all three monotheist religions are traditionally against cremation. That's different from most of the other religions. So there must be something important about that. We better take that into consideration.
There was a hand over here.
What's the difference between prime matter and signet matter? And then how does signet matter fit into that picture?
Well, I use that term. I'm not sure how technically good that is. I know I've seen it in places. It's just a way of saying something with some kind of form. So, for example, we can speak of food as matter for us, right? But it has a kind of form, and it has to have some kind of form. So it has to be, rocks won't do for us, right, to eat. You have to have only certain kinds of things work as food for us that are good for us. But they get broken down. I mean, they don't stay, wheat doesn't stay wheat, and meat doesn't stay meat. It gets all changed around. But it's still kind of material for us. But it has a form to it that's important for us in order to be prepared. Prime matter is what Lisa and Father was talking about all the way down. I mean, prime matter is when you don't have any signification anymore. So, I mean, an example. It still doesn't. I mean, because science, when you take chemistry and such, they'll tend to speak of matter as, they're not speaking philosophically the way Thomas would about matter. They don't mean prime matter. They talk about the atom. Well, the atom still has a formality to it. Protons, neutrons, electrons, they have a kind of a formality. They have form. If you have a chemical reaction, oxygen, hydrogen joining to make water, you have energy released, and then water produced from the combustion of hydrogen and oxygen, right? Well, law of conservation of matter says the stuff that you start with, the mass, is going to be the same at the end. Energy gets... There's a broader sense in which matter includes energy as well. That's what E equals mc squared means. But basically, what you start with is what you finish with. And the medievals had a kind of a similar sense, although energy wouldn't have been part of that. But you can see that what you weigh at the start in some way has to have the same mass at the end. But in the world, really, you never find prime matter just sitting by itself. It's there's always some kind of form. So that's the hylomorphic theory, basically.
So does it only exist, or can we say that it only exists like in potentiality on its? It's like a
pure potency, but
yeah.
That's a big topic, but I think you have the basic idea. But it's like a pure quantitative potency, if you will. I'm not sure if that's a perfect definition, but the question back here. I don't know what kind of time we have, but
maybe just till 12:30.
Okay.
I have a couple of questions. They might be short answers. The first one you hinted at earlier with the weeping and gnashing of teeth.
Mm-hmm.
Are the souls of the condemned reunited to their bodies?
Yeah, that's a belief. So the chief texts on that are John 5:28-29, and then, if you look this up in the catechism, this is what you'll find, but John, that text, and then I think Matthew 25, the last judgment, verses whatever it is, 30 to 45, somewhere in there. There might be another one.
Daniel.
Sorry, pardon?
Daniel?
Maybe.
The end of Daniel is the bit about the resurrection. It's some to everlasting life, some to everlasting. It's like there's a...
Okay, interesting. That's not one I tend to think about. There might be another one. There are some texts. There's one text as to all would be judged according to what they did in the body. That's not about the universal resurrection. I could find more. In any case, that's
so my second question sort of builds off of that. Does St. Thomas give any idea of what it means in Philippians that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow and every tongue confess that Christ is Lord? What that might look like or what?
Yeah, I mean, so at the final judgment, it's one of the reasons he gives for the... This is a reason of fittingness. I mean, a lot of theological arguments are reasons for fittingness, right? Because we can't... Something's revealed... some things that are revealed simply make clear things that can be known from reason, but some things that are revealed are properly available to us only because they're revealed. And then, quite often, we can't be sure exactly why they are the way they are, but they are revealed to us. And this is one thing that's revealed, that all will be raised. And Thomas says it's fitting because it's fitting for... one judged to be to see his judge, in a sense that the judge appear before them and offer a sentence, and so Christ in his humanity will be the judge of all, and they will rise to judgment. It's one of the reasons for the resurrection. All rise to judgment. The damned won't see his glory. In fact, his appearance to them will be a great pain to them because they will not be suited to seeing him.
Do we have any indication about what Adam and Eve's beatitude would have looked like apart from the fall? Or specifically, would it be something very different? Would their experience of beatitude be different than ours, we hope, will be in the resurrection because of the uniqueness of Christ's salvation and the resurrection in Christ?
Mm.
I know that's very speculative.
Believe it or not, Thomas talks about what would have happened if Adam and Eve had not sinned, they were with God, right? They were so Thomas's position, and this was not universally held, but because some held that they were in kind of a state of natural goodness, and that this would have allowed them then to proceed forward and move toward grace and glory. Thomas says, well, you need God's help in order to choose God. You're not naturally capable of in a sense, perfecting yourself and being admitted to the divine company. That's a kind of gift. So they start in a state of grace, basically, and they would have progressed to the point where they finally were confirmed in the good and would have been somehow introduced into the beatific vision. How that would have been different exactly, I don't think Thomas talks about. what could one say about it? Well, you know, when we spoke about the wounds of Jesus, so that there's a kind of difference that past makes in him. And I think something kind of analogous would be the case for any soul that had been saved in such a way. That is, there is a kind of way in which, you know, the past would come with you, with the souls of the just, so that there, you know, there's, you wouldn't speak of the emotion that occurs to me is a kind of relief from being saved from what one had seen. Connected with this is the notion that some kind of greater good comes from there having been evil and that evil having been overcome. I'm not going to speculate myself, but there could be something you could do with that. So maybe a couple more.
In thinking about the souls of the damned being reunited with their bodies, would that be similar to how the beatitude of the souls of the just isn't perfected, it's just an extensive increase? Like, would the souls of the damned then have a similar extensive increase in punishment versus a perfection of punishment?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would think so, because, and so partly thinking about this on the fly here, the principal punishment of the damned is separation from God. Although they can't be completely separated from him, otherwise they wouldn't exist, but it's separation from the vision of God, and it's kind of, and Thomas teaches that's the greatest punishment of the damned. But then this is expressed in all kinds of ways. Like there's a kind of a darkness of the mind, a kind of hatred one for the other, a kind of heaviness in the soul, and then all of this also in the body. But so I would say yes. You know, the essence of damnation would have to be not being in the company of God. And the souls of the damned would apply to them already.
So I think it's appropriate if we now just acknowledge and applaud and thank our two main presenters here, Father Brian and Father Anselm.